We all want to build a better business so we can be better architects. Well, a better business starts with planning your profit. Download our free course, Profit for Small Firm Architects, at entrearchitect.com/freecourse. You are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, episode 142. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. The difficult choice to pick a target market and focus all your energy, all your resources, and all your effort on that one market is a decision many of us small firm architects are afraid to make. We're afraid of missing out on other opportunities, or we worry that we'll have all our eggs in one basket when that next recession shows up. You've heard me talk about this before. Pick a target market, become an expert, and you will find that your next best client will find their way to you. I'm very excited about this week's special guest. He's an architect who has succeeded by making that decision to focus on a target market early on in his development, in the development of his firm. And he's thrived for more than 30 years because of it. This week at Entree Architect Podcast, Dale Mulfinger of Sala Architects joins me and shares his hard-earned knowledge on how to succeed as a residential architect. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is sponsored by TrueStyle, the leader in high-end architectural interior doors. Learn more at TrueStyle.com. And Tanglewood Conservatories, combining the romanticism of the 19th century glass architecture with state-of-the-art technology of today. Learn more at TanglewoodConservatories.com. Dale Mulfinger, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for being here. You're the founder and principal of the residential architecture firm Sala Architects. You're based in Minnesota with two offices, one in Minneapolis and one in Stillwater. It's great having you here. I'm really excited that you're here. Sala, I've been following Sala for a long time. I love what you guys do. And I love not only the architecture that you do, it's just the presence and the brand of Sala. And that's very, it's really great to see a residential architecture firm thrive the way that Sala has. You were introduced to me by our mutual friend, Stacia Hood, who was one of your employees. And now she's on to building her own project, The Thrivable Home, which she was on the podcast not too long ago, episode 136. Listeners may also recognize the name of your firm, Sala, through your co-founder and former partner, Sarah Susanka, who is the author of the Not So Big House book series. But in addition to being an architect, you're also an advocate for the profession and an author and a teacher in many, many ways, which is really why I wanted you here on the show today. In fact, you're actually going to be an expert guest at our training at Entree Architect Academy next week, which I'm really excited to have you over there. So our members can sort of get a connection with you, learn from you, and then be able to ask some questions and learn how to be successful in residential architecture. But I wanted to bring you to the podcast so you can we can bring your knowledge and your thoughts to the Entree Architect community at large. So I'm really excited to have you here to talk about residential architecture. And before we get into that, I wanted to get into your origin story, which is what we do with all our guests. I'd love to go back to when you discovered architecture, when you discovered that architecture was a thing and was a profession, and what inspired you to decide to become an architect, and then give us your story and your journey to where you find yourself today.
Well, my background as far as getting into architecture starts probably from being a farm kid growing up in rural Minnesota. And I learned very early that farming wasn't quite for me, so I was probably on hunt for something else. And in the process, I excelled in a drafting program in high school. It really didn't orient me specifically to architecture, but to the art of drafting and understanding how to draw worm gear and all those great things. And probably saw myself as heading in the direction of mechanical drafting. But perchance, I took a test to get into the university, and I succeeded. And somebody asked me what program I was going to attend, and I said, well, maybe architecture. And that's where I arrived at the university. And you might say I never looked back from that point. So I happened to enter the Department of Architecture with an amazing group of peers who are many of my closest friends still today, so many years after. And I think through their help, I emerged 6 years later as a young architect. In the early, my early professional career, I really was focused on urban design. So I spent a decade in urban design working on planning and developments, campus planning, large city developments, urban design, so forth. And over a decade, I came to the realization that urban design takes a very long time to implement, if it ever gets implemented. And I decided I would probably prefer to get a little bit closer to buildings. So I started working for architects, both abroad and here in Minneapolis. And gradually the projects, as they got smaller and smaller, I enjoyed them more and more. And out of that essentially came an understanding that I might really enjoy residential architecture. And then I had an opportunity to design a house according to the ideas put forth by Christopher Alexander in the pattern link.
Yeah, great.
And I happened to have this graduate student by the name of Sarah Sasenka, who was well steeped in that theory and idea. And I said, Sarah, why don't you join me and we'll do this house together? And that was the beginning of our firm.
Oh, so great. That's a great story.
1983, and we did a little $75,000 house based on 26 patterns from the pattern language. And quite early on, I realized that it's fun to talk about these projects. And so I wrote an article in Fine Home Building about that pattern language house. And I'm still writing today for Taunton Press. So some things you know, stay with me, you might say.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great story. A Pattern Language is a great book. If anybody doesn't know, it's a big, thick, yellow book, and it talks about patterns, about how architecture works, right? I mean, that's essentially the idea behind it.
Right. 33 years later, I was in San Francisco a few months ago, in fact, a day before I saw you up at the conference, mm-hmm. and interviewing, or you might say two young people were interviewing me to be their architect for a cabin in Minnesota. And about 5 minutes into the interview, the husband said, by the way, have you ever run across a book called A Pattern Language? No, never heard of it.
That's so funny. How everything is a cycle and it all comes back.
That's right.
Yeah, that's so funny. So you mentioned cabins. That's your passion today, right?
Well, yeah, about halfway along in this Sala gig, I was asked to design a cabin, and I realized I didn't, although they're around me everywhere in Minnesota, I didn't know all that much about them because I didn't grow up with a cabin in my family background. So I, like I've done with a lot of things, I decided to research it. And in the process of researching cabins, I started writing articles about them for a local magazine. 72 articles later, I think I maybe, you know, gleaned some knowledge. And then I started doing books for Taunton Press on that same subject. And I'm about to finish up the most recent book that will be published in 2017 to be called The Family Cabin.
That's great. How many books on cabins have you written so far?
This would be the fifth book for Taunton Press. Yes. Yeah. And probably one of the more interesting ones is one called Cabinology.
Yeah, that's the one I recognize. What is it about the cabin that inspires you so much to sort of focus on that?
I think, you know, sometimes you follow into places that you don't think are being served very well. So here we are in Minnesota, and you think of all the cabins we have around here, and yet nobody really focused on it deeply enough to understand it very well. So people, a lot of architects did kind of a one-off cabin for their client in order to get the bank job or whatever else they might be going in. But nobody really had looked at it closely. And so I just dug into it, and there was a big void of you know, needing some architectural discussion. So the other things about a cabin is I love the scale of the small scale of them. And I really appreciate the fact that most of my clients think of their cabin as a legacy project. And so they are willing and desirous of putting a phenomenal amount of their own personality into it. So each cabin is uniquely different because the people are different. And that makes them very rewarding. It's also fun to be able to go back and stay at your project and do a little fishing while you're there.
Yeah, it's a great target market for vacations.
Right.
So when you say a legacy project, you mean that they're sort of building them for generations beyond them?
They presume that their children will inherit this and seek to inherit it, whereas their suburban home, they know that's going to be resold to somebody who, you know, totally unrelated to them.
Yeah. Yeah. My mom and dad have a small cabin built probably in the turn of the century, a little fishing shack, really, up on the St. Lawrence River in New York. And that's exactly what it is. It is a place where we all go and we gather and have, you know, we build memories there. It's such a special place.
Right. And I think that's what makes working on cabins so much fun is all those special places and all those special people.
Yeah. I can imagine. Go ahead.
Another kind of anecdote to that is I would say in about a fifth of the projects I work on, a meeting might in fact have multiple family members in the meeting.
Yeah, that must be difficult at times.
That always presents a bit of a challenge, but we work our way through it.
Yeah, yeah, and that's part of residential architecture, right? I mean, having sometimes multiple points of view and having to solve problems for multiple different, you know, multiple people.
We do a lot of family counseling, a lot of marriage counseling.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. So you one of the things that you advocate is success in residential architecture. You've done well with Sala. If people go to salaarchitects.com, you can see their website. Very well done. Very well put together. Great branding. All through social media. Again, very consistent there as well. Let's go through some of the things that you've learned through your years of working and building Sala and why it's become what it is today. Would you be willing to do that with us?
Sure, of course.
Go ahead.
We started 33 years ago, and Sarah Sosenka and I, and we sort of realized fairly early on that there wasn't anyone focusing directly on residential in our area, or there were hardly anyone. And we further realized that if we got the word out to the public that we were really interested in doing houses, the public turned out to be anxious for architects to jump in. So very early on, we learned that there was just a gigantic market that was being unserved, and we jumped in full force, and thus we grew rapidly to a much larger firm. And I think in my own feeling is that there's still a lot more market there yet to be served. So I guess I'm still rather optimistic that even though we now have a lot of residential architects, particularly here in the Twin Cities and in a number of our metropolises around the country, there's still a lot of unserved clients who want to do better things. That doesn't necessarily mean they want to do what you want to do, but they want to create better homes. And of course, their definition of better is pretty broad, and it might mean just energy performance. It could mean beauty. It could mean making it smaller and better, as Sarah would say. But they all want to, in one way or another, make it better. And if you're in there willing to help them, they're more than willing to pay for your service.
And you discovered early on in your career that you enjoyed residential architecture. And you wanted to build this firm around residential architecture. So you chose to not do other types of architecture. Was that a scary decision to make? I find that many architects, I talk about the target market a lot, that architects should find a target market and serve that market to be successful. That's one of the steps to get there. Do you agree with that? And how did you get past that fear of choosing just one?
Sarah and I actually started the firm thinking that we were going to be doing multifamily housing. And we marketed rather heavily towards that with various developers. And while we were marketing that, we happened to be doing additions, remodelings, and a few new homes. And it took us a few months, not necessarily a year, to realize that, wait a minute, the homework is paying the bills, and this other work is just draining our profits. So we said, well, what if we started to market? What if we actually started to tell the public we wanted to do their house or we wanted to do their addition? Would there be anybody around? And as soon as we realized the scale of that market and how fast the phone started ringing, we really didn't have any fear. Our fear was how to serve it well, and how to grow a firm comfortably, but not necessarily that we were in a market that was dried up or, you know, that wouldn't sustain itself. So I think other than a few financial turndown, you know, certainly the various recessionary times that we've had, and the big one most recently, you know, the market has been sustaining itself pretty well. And even in the recession, it didn't dry up completely. Our piece of the market seemed to stay open during the recession.
So, was there any point where you decided you were thinking that maybe residential wasn't a good idea to focus on, and maybe I should have been more broad?
I I'm still an architect who would at times love to say, oh, wouldn't it be fun to do a high rise, 120 story tower, or, you know, I mean, I love other things, and through academia, I often get involved in other scope, you know, the projects of scope and scale. But that said, I know there's a wealth of really talented architects already serving those markets well. And so I'm going to stay focused on, you know, these segments of the market that I've identified for myself and the firm. Now, our firm has done other work, other non-residential work, and there's certainly people in our office who might like to do more of that. So we've done a mortuary, a public library, some commercial buildings. You know, we continue to do a few of those projects as they happen to fall into our lap.
Yeah. And I, you know, one of the things I advocate is that if you pick that target market and you become known for that, and then you become an expert in that one market, then people recognize you as a successful firm and that you're good at that. And then they do start to bring in other opportunities for you because they've made that connection through the residential work that they've done.
That's right. So I think we get the libraries because somebody wanted a library that felt as nice as a home.
Right.
And somebody wanted a mortuary that felt rather home-like and not commercial. So I think other projects have been identified because we happen to know people or offer a service that they feel they would enjoy.
Let's take a quick break here to say thank you to two of our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, True Style Doors and Tanglewood Conservatories. As platform sponsors, these companies have provided funding and support for our overall mission to become an influential force in the profession of architecture. They recognize the need for small firms like you and me to build better businesses in order to be better architects. And both of these companies are run by great people. I've met them. They're passionate about their products and they want to share their knowledge with you. So listen up and connect with them. Say thanks for sponsoring Entree Architect. Then specify their products, and by supporting them, you'll be supporting us. True Style is passionate about providing us small firm architects with the inspiration and tools to transform our designs with the most distinctive, authentic, and the most special doors available. With more than 400 made-to-order styles, True Style offers premium MDF doors for painted applications and 20, count them, 20 standard species of wood across all architectural categories, from traditional to contemporary and everything in between. Every True Style door is made to order. True Style, driven by design. Visit TrueStyle.com and start designing your doors today. That's True Style, TrueStyle.com. And my friends at Tanglewood Conservatories, they custom design and they build authentic residential and commercial conservatories, combining the romanticism of the 19th century glass architecture with state-of-the-art technology and master craftsmanship. Whether your designs call for a pool enclosure, a gazebo, a greenhouse, a unique light-filled living space. Tanglewood Conservatories will help you create a custom masterpiece for your clients. These things are beautiful. Check them out at tanglewoodconservatories.com. Just go peek around. Amazing photographs of the things they've built there. Tanglewood Conservatories, anything else is just a room. For more information, go visit tanglewoodconservatories.com. What are some of the things that you did in order to be recognized as a residential firm? How did you get the word out that that's what you wanted to do?
I would say the two most common things we did early on were, one, getting articles in our local newspaper about projects that we found interesting, and those tended to be remodelings and additions. And then we also started courses that the public could attend about residential architecture. And we did those in a number of venues where there was already kind of a guaranteed market. So adult education through the university or through our local science center or art centers, they often have adult ed classes, and there's a ready market. They're already advertising for other classes. So if you jump in, it's usually a fairly well-educated group of people that show up, and from those, you get clients. And you may not get a client by the end of the day of that program, but over the next couple of years, people will come back to you and say, gee, I remember what you said in that program, and therefore, you know, I'd really like to have you do that addition to my home. So I think we just found ways to meet the public. Okay. And still, we very much believe that we need to always be informing the public that we're really proud of what we do. And as long as we're proud of what we do, other people will want us to help them.
So would you say today the two main marketing tools that you're using is still publishing and teaching?
Yeah, they're probably the dominant ones, yes. Obviously, I would say still the majority of our work comes through word of mouth. That is to say, have the clients pass your name along to the neighbor or to Uncle Bud. But that's the dominant one, is to always make sure your clients feel good by the end of the day.
Right.
And therefore, they'll recommend you to someone, or your builder will recommend you to someone. Just had that happen yesterday, builder recommending me. But our other markets, reaching the people who don't yet know you, that's a matter of, classes, lectures, articles. And there's, in my estimation, no better source of articles, a place for articles, than your local newspaper. So we've actually helped start programs that aren't just helpful to us, as in Sala, but are helpful to all of the residential architects of the community. So we have a program with our newspaper called Home of the Month. And each month they feature a house done by an architect, and we compete for those slots. So there are 12 slots per year, and we get about 40 to 45 submissions from our residential community, our residential architectural community, and then an unbiased panel picks the 12 for that coming year, and then we wait a year and repeat it, and that's just a great source. And it's been, you know, even though we don't necessarily get, you know, but we only get 2, 3, 4 of those slots ourselves, it's a boon to our profession. So it's really helpful. And then out of that has come other articles within the newspaper. So the newspaper may see that the commission only picked the 12, but they actually want a 13th. And they'll call you up and say, couldn't I publish that? We say, sure. I think the thing to remember that I like to tell my colleagues in the profession is magazine editors and newspaper editors stare at blank pages wondering how the hell to fill them. And so help them out of their misery.
So you've actually not only written articles, you've created programs with publishers to get residential architecture exposure.
Yes. About a dozen years ago, I went into our local newspaper and said, I've got this idea about the Home of the Month idea. And I thought for sure I'd have a terrible, it would be a very hard sell, and how would I ever, you know, get there? And I said, by the way, we've got photography already done. We'll help you with the article. These will be, you know, owners who are willing to speak. And this woman editor looked at me and said, "Where the hell you been?" So it took off right away, and it's been going now for at least a dozen years.
And that's
we didn't invent that idea. We actually exported that idea from Seattle.
And it was another architect doing something similar, another publication?
Seattle had a similar newspaper program, a little bit different than ours, but it's an idea we took from Seattle and then made it work in our community. And we have other programs. We have something called a Rave Award, and so that's with a local magazine. So there are other ways that we get the work of our residential architectural community out into the public view.
And so your intent is to get exposure for residential architecture,
right,
and to make a connection, right? Because, I mean, some of the articles are really, you're not making a personal connection, but the teaching is making a personal connection. The awards, maybe, you know, maybe that's something where you're making a physical, you know, an actual connection with somebody where you're meeting them.
Yeah. One of the notable things that you can communicate if you do an adult ed class is there you can communicate theories and ideas broader than, say, a project. So in a newspaper article, they're going to speak on a kind of a lay text, if you will. But if you actually conduct a class, you can introduce the public to pattern language, or you can introduce the public to passive solar design, or any number of ideas, so that 2 years later, by the time somebody arrives at your door, they already know you for a set of ideas, and you don't have to hand them a book and say, "Read this first before we begin."
Right. So some of the passions that you have as an architect, you can teach those passions, like, as, you know, pattern language or maybe passive house or whatever you want. You're building your firm around, and something that gets you excited that you want to share with others. Pick that and go share it with the general public.
That's right. Now, you can do that also with articles, but sometimes, depending upon the nature of the place you're writing the article, as to how technical you can be or how specific to a theory or an idea to be. Generally, they want a more accommodating, kind of soft article.
So you go out there and you do all that marketing, essentially, and
right,
you have people start calling you, right?
That's right. It starts working.
So yes, once those calls come in, how do you get that work done? Do you have processes in place in the firm? And talk a little bit about how the firm is structured.
Well, what's unique about us as a firm is we're organized much more horizontally than a firm would commonly be a firm of 26 or people. Before the recession, we had about 40 people. So we're organized horizontally with 13 different project architects. So what that means to us is, whether you're a principal or an associate in our office, you have your own client, you do your own design, you essentially do your own projects. And so you are your own entity as far as an architect goes. You're supported by the firm. The management structure is there to help you. But we don't police your theories and ideas that you want to put forth into the public arena. We enjoy the fact that you're a little bit different than I am. You know, that somehow you'll do it this way and I'll do it that way, and you're more interested in the history and I'm more interested in the avant-garde. Whatever your interests are, we appreciate the fact that our 13 individuals have a great diversity of interests, and so we can handle a pretty broad set of queries that come into the office. Now, you might ask, there are two common questions that come about from that. What keeps young architects in our office? And I think what we've learned from attorneys, and I would say that our ideas come almost directly from law offices, which have a similar model. What keeps attorneys in a law office, what keeps an architect in a larger office, is camaraderie, is the fact that a certain number of architects really enjoy doing what they do in a group. Now, that's not every architect. I mean, there's an awful lot of architects who would like to do it alone, or maybe with just a few people, and they like the power of being fully in control. And that's just not us. I mean, that's fine. That's one alternative. We have a different alternative, and that is, for people who enjoyed the studio experience back when they were in college, this is just like a big studio. And we can critique each other, but we basically support each other and learn from each other.
Are you also responsible for bringing in your own projects?
Yes and no. I mean, if you're a younger associate, then you don't have all of the contacts that I might have, being the senior guy around here. You need to be nurtured. So I need to take some of my excess work, if you will, or excess phone calls, and make sure they slip over to some of the younger staff when that can be done. So yeah, it takes some nurturing of more junior associates. But you begin to realize early on that if you want the kind of work you really love to work on, you need to get out there and mine the market for that kind of work. So that means you need to teach the class, you need to get an article, and you see what your senior associates do. So you kind of, you know, you fairly quickly find the model that works for you. And it's not the same model for everyone. Not everybody's a public speaker. Not everybody is a good writer. Although I think everybody could be a good writer, because there are these magical people called editors that make us sound like we know what we're talking about. But anyway, I think, you know, everybody has to find their own venue for getting out into the public world and say, wow, I'm really proud of what I do, and here are some of the things I've been able to do already.
Do you have any formal mentoring processes that are in SALA, or is it sort of informal?
It's pretty informal. We don't have too much of a formal structure for that. Mm-hmm. And it varies because each individual is so unique. And some come readily made with their own ability to they've already got a community they're connected to, and others, they really need a nurture in order to find that community.
And you said administrative support you share. Do you also share, like, design support, draftsmen?
Yes. We share staff. Mm-hmm. We share the management of the office and finances. And even though we're 13 individual architects with our own clients, the money all goes into a central pool. I mean, it's not like everybody's an individual profit center.
So all the billing is handled by somebody else, and it's all goes into one account?
Correct. Yes.
And everybody gets salaries, essentially.
The checks flow into one account, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the inverse, you know, there's a way to, you know, another thing we learned from attorneys is, if that's the case, how do you determine financial fairness? And,
right.
You know, we've developed our own models of what fairness means. So there's kind of a point ranking system that, you know, if you're more senior, or if you have done more work over the course of the year, you know, there's more money coming in under your name. All of those things kind of represent a different set of values as far as what your compensation might be versus somebody else.
Are there certain types of people that you're looking for as you grow, when you're hiring people?
Well, I think we're always looking for people who have a diverse set of talents, who have a good sense of kind of meeting the public. You know, they have to be good on their feet in terms of understanding how they're going to work with clients and how they're going to work with a public audience. They have to be generally good all-around designers. I mean, they have to have good skill set. And then they have to enjoy working with a group. I mean, they're not, you don't want somebody who's a classic loner who really wants to go hide off by themselves. So, yeah, there are a number of things one looks for. Or if you don't necessarily see all that up front. So, I mean, you know, there's a certain testing period when younger staff can come in and sort of, you know, we look at them, they look at us as they begin to perform professional tasks.
And what are your thoughts on growing the firm? Is your intent to focus on growth, or do you just find this balance of where you want to be and you sort of try to maintain that balance?
I don't think there's ever really been overt notion that the firm had to grow, that we, you know, are trying to become 60 people or something like that.
Right.
I think growth has been more an outcome of phone calls that come in, and how do you serve them, and how do you not let that phone call go off to somebody else that's outside of the firm. So if you want that phone call to stay within the firm, and you get too busy, then you add somebody. And I think we try and have done over the years a pretty good job of knowing who's out there in the community and available to work with us, you know, should we need more staff. So we always try and keep our ear to the ground as far as who's graduating. That's one of the advantages of teaching is you know some of the great talent coming out of schools, and we try and connect with a lot of other schools other than just our local one. So I regularly do reviews down at the University of Arkansas, or you know, somebody else does it at a different school, so that we know we have a broader base of talent than just our own region.
Have your leaders and your principals grown from the bottom up? Have you grown them internally, or did you bring them on as partners externally?
All of the above. Some grew up internally. Others came to us midstream, if you might say, or they were already somewhat accomplished, but they wanted to join our group. So, yeah, we've had diverse ways that people have come to the firm. And they've come from beyond our region at times, or most of them come from within the region.
And you have multiple offices. You have two offices now, right? You had three at one time.
We had three. I would say the third one was really just knocked out by the recession, and we didn't really have a need for it. I think our multiple offices are more a product of where people will have wanted to live, mm-hmm. rather than did we necessarily overtly want to have multiple offices. Whether we do or do not have multiple offices probably isn't that critical.
So it's more of a response to the flexibility of the
right.
The staff.
Yeah, and it certainly gets a little more complicated as you start to have multiple offices. But we've always had Minneapolis as kind of a central office. That's where our core management is, and we've got a Stuart office because Stuart is a beautiful little town where some architects love to live. So. And our work we do not geographically structure, you know, where our projects go. Sometimes it's more convenient for them to be in Stillwater. Sometimes it's more convenient to be in Minneapolis. But one of my Stillwater colleagues was just in here yesterday in our Minneapolis office meeting with her client. So it's that client has a project in Minneapolis. So. We really do a lot of regional work, and the regional work is done out of both offices.
How many people in each office?
We're about totally about 26. So I think we're about 7 in Stillwater right now. And it kind of varies a little bit. Some of that Stillwater staff has been in here helping in Minneapolis. So it's a smaller group out in our Stillwater office.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to share? If there was a residential architect who came to you and they're just struggling, trying to get, you know, they've been in business for 5-6 years and they've been trying to do all the things that they're trying to do, what would you say to that struggling architect? What are some of the things that they should be focusing on to sort of turn things around to get things going in the right direction?
Well, if they're proud of what they've done so far, you know, if they've had a few years and built a few projects and they're proud of what they've done, then they definitely need to find a way to share that with the world, you know, with their immediate environment. So finding a way to get their work published, I think, is important. And the more local, if that's where they want to do their work, the more local they can get it published, the better they are to get additional projects. I think it starts with putting a lawn sign out in front of your construction project. And that's it. It does a number of things. One, it says I'm proud of what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
But it also says, here's my phone number. Give me a call. And it's maybe the cheapest and simplest device you can do. And I'm often amazed at the number of people who don't do that. But that's where it starts. And then I think you build off that and say, well, can I talk about this on a local level, or do I want to talk about it more nationally? And, you know, if you want your work to be more national, then you want to move out into national magazines or national press. And that's just more arduous to try and figure out how to do that. But you can write articles for Fine Home Building, or, you know, you can attempt to get an article in the Washington Post. But,
right.
You know, that's a bit more challenging to do either of those. You don't do them as often.
Yeah.
Whereas your local newspaper is always looking for material.
Yeah, the more national journals really takes networking. You really need to know the people inside those systems.
Mm-hmm.
I've written about that on the blog.
And if you're not a writer, not a lot of architects don't consider themselves a writer, but almost all architects, and it may have to do with the educational model where you have to present your project to a peer group of faculty, and you learn to talk, you learn to be able to talk about your project. And everybody, you know, if you ask an architect about their current project or the one they just finished, they can talk for hours on it. And most of them would turn around and say, well, I can't write. And you say, yeah, but you can talk. And if you can talk, you can talk into a microphone. And you'd be amazed at what you say once you hear yourself. If somebody's recording what you say, you can turn around and write from the basis of that recording. And so that's kind of how I learned to write, is listening to my recordings. And from that, starting to write. Now I can write independently of having to record myself, but I couldn't initially. So there are a lot of ways to get your ideas out and let the world know that you're interested in this stuff.
That's a great tip. I mean, everybody's walking around with a smartphone in their pocket. All you have to do is hit the audio recording button and start talking. And actually, there's websites now that you can send that audio to, and they'll edit it for you. They'll actually format it in a way that becomes much more usable.
It's very easy to find editors. If you don't think you can talk well, it's very easy to find an editor who will clean up your bad English or your bad grammar, whatever it is. And that's easily done.
Yeah. Dale, thank you so much for joining me here today and sharing your knowledge. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, I look forward to chatting with you and your group in a week.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. Your website is salaarchitects.com. You're all over social media as well, facebook.com/Sala, Pinterest, House, Twitter, all Sala Architects. You can just search for you there. And Dale, before we wrap up, I want to ask you the same question that I ask many of my guests as we wrap up. This is a question about what somebody can do, what an architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow. What is one thing that they can, like, just stop what they're doing and do something right now that's going to affect their success in the future?
I think probably your success, you've been reasonably successful as a person. But can you be successful with more people, with the staff around you, with the staff you might hire in the future? And I think you really need to look at that staff and say, are they going somewhere that's comfortable for them? And how can we go there together? And how can I nurture them as a group of people? I think recognizing that almost all of the architects that get into this profession with us were educated in a way that promotes entrepreneurship. You know, that whole jury process where you have to stand up and defend yourself in front of those tough academics really sets you up for being an entrepreneur. And so almost everybody around you, maybe not those coming out of a drafting tradition, but those coming out of architectural education, are there to support what you do, but they're also there to grow themselves. And I think if you grow them, you will grow yourself too. So that would be my suggestion.
Yeah, that's great advice. Every one of us, our success is the result of the people around us. It's very, very hard to become successful in anything as a lone dog. It's just you. Even the ones that look like they're doing it all by themselves have somebody out there who's supporting them and helping them. So that's really great advice.
I would have never gotten onto this technology today if it hadn't been for a couple of young people here in the office showed me how to do it.
Well, I'm glad that you did, because I'm really happy that we had the opportunity to have you share your knowledge with the Entre Architect podcast today.
Okay. Thank you, Mark.
Complete show notes and a direct link to download this episode will be found at entrearchitect.com/episode142. And don't forget to visit the website and gain access to our digital course, Profit for Small Firm Architects, and learn how to build a powerful profit plan that will work for your small firm. Visit entrearchitect.com and click the button right there on the homepage. Hundreds of architects have taken this course. It's a great place to start when you're building a better business. And it's free. Visit entrearchitect.com and click the button and gain access to Profit for Small Firm Architects today. My name is Mark Arlepage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. And I encourage you to build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.